So this talk's on an equation that's much simpler than most of the equations we've heard about so far in this meeting. It's classical 5-4 field theory in one space dimension. There's really two talks combined to one, and the work in the first part of the talk is with Salman Habib, who in fact made some of the transparencies that some of you will recognize. So the first part of the talk is what Salman likes to call the secret life of kinks. The idea being, if you run this field theory to equilibrium, the equilibrium balance, meaning the number of kink anti-kinks on the lattice, is actually, this is maintained at a steady value by a dynamical process of annihilation and nucleation and various other things. So there's actually a lot going on there that you wouldn't first think of, and that's why we call it the secret life of kinks. And this first slide is something telling you why you might be interested in this sort of thing. Various applications, although I'm not really going to go into any of the applications. In fact, I don't have a particular one in mind. But from my point of view, it's a good thing that there's actually a stochastic PDE or a classical field theory that we can actually do quite a lot with, calculate quite a lot about, and do quite a lot of equilibrium and non-equilibrium stuff with. So the actual equation that I'm going to talk about for most of the first part of the talk is that number one. So phi is a function of space and time. There's a space-time white noise, second derivative in time. It's non-linear and it's been non-dimensionalized. So really the only two parameters left are the damping and the amplitude of the noise, or equivalently the temperature. Now this equation, if you get rid of the noise and the damping and in fact the time derivative, then you've just got an ODE in X. It has a solution called a kink solution that just joins minus 1 to plus 1, being those are the two potential minima. The question is, what happens if I solve this thing at finite temperature? How many kinks do I get? What do they do? So here, this first graph, I've actually shown you one time slice, or it's actually one part of a time slice. So I run this thing for a long time at a finite temperature, and I look at the configuration at some time. So what do I see? I see a lot of things like this, joined by regions where it's close to either minus 1 or plus 1. So each dot there is the value at a grid point at one time, and that line is slightly more than just a guide to the eye. It's actually a useful way of identifying exactly where kinks are. You see, if I start with this, just these dots, and draw a line through them, then I'm going to overcount the number of kinks because the noise is making it the actual thing quite jagged here. If I just count number of zero crossings, I'm going to overcount the number of kinks. But what you can do is just stop your run at some time, sort of go to a side, or go to a subroutine with that configuration, turn off the noise, and then just let it cool for some time period. And what that does is it damps out very rapidly all this stuff. You can't actually see there's a horizontal line through here, and gives you a very nice configuration where you can easily count the kinks. That's just a practical detail.
Why do you get more than one kink at finite
temperature? You should expect the kink has a mass, so you would expect the density of kinks that roughly goes like e to the minus the kink mass over your temperature.
The sort of mathematically, the equation at zero temperature, you have one kink.
There is a kink solution, but if you start with arbitrary initial conditions, there's no reason why you should only see one kink.
And that should be true at zero temperature.
That's right. Even at zero temperature, if you start with arbitrary initial conditions, you'll see. Okay. At zero temperature, if I start with arbitrary initial conditions, I'll in general see a huge number of kinks. If I wait long enough, it'll slowly merge. It eventually, in fact, I won't even see one. I'll just see a flat configuration. If I'm at finite temperature, then the number of kinks won't decay to zero. It'll decay to some finite number, which is basically driven by the finite temperature. That's one of the first things I'm going to come to.
Yeah,
That's right. It's a one-dimensional, yeah, just one space dimension.
What's the temperature here?
So the non-dimensional temperature is beta equals 8, which is defined up there. So beta is the inverse temperature. The larger I make beta, the smaller the temperature is. Sorry? The energy in these non-dimensional units is a square root of 8 over 9. So it's very close to 1. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, one of the things we've tried to do better than previous people is use large enough lattices that we can get good statistics and also run things for long enough. Exactly. But again, since we've made it so large, it shouldn't matter. It just happens to be most convenient. Please ask questions. This is good. Okay. So people started to do some calculations on these in the 70s and 80s, and you can, in principle, calculate any thermodynamic quantity you want from the transfer integral, which I'll go into again in a second. Basically, the transfer integral gives you a Schrodinger equation from which you evaluate some eigenvalues, and that tells you things like correlation lengths. And from the correlation length, you can get the number of the density of kinks and also some other things which I'll talk about. And the Schrodinger equation that you have to solve has as its potential just the on-site potential, so it's the 5-4 potential. If you solve that at low temperature, the temperature here is acting like an H-bar thing, or beta is acting like an H-bar. So at large beta, I'm seeing very deep double wells, and the structure of the eigenvalue spectrum looks like there's a very small tunnel splitting, and it's that tunnel splitting which gives you the correlation length and hence the number of kinks. So from all of that came this prediction in the 70s and 80s of the density of kinks that you should see at finite temperature if the temperature is low enough that this approximation is valid. So it agrees with what you'd expect. There is a kink mass, which is very close to 1, and you would expect the number of kinks to have this Boltzmann-type factor in it. And this seems to work, but again, no one's really been able to do much precise calculation until recently that we've had big enough computers to do it on. And so you can also define this quantity, which actually comes out of the same calculation. Well, I wouldn't use that language. It's simply a case of, if you look at this graph, I see kinks. I also see a lot of junk around here. And this is actually harmonic oscillator type sloshing around in the potential minimum. So there's obviously a lot of energy stored in there. And there's an interesting sort of feedback about how these phonons affect the kink, which again I'll come back to.
But what you're saying, there's an analytic calculation
for
using this transfer integral?
The transfer integral doesn't explicitly separate what's a kink and what's a phonon. The transfer integral can give you, in principle, exact expressions for things like the correlation function. And from that, you have to really...
The kink energy you think is a sort of free parameter here?
No. The kink energy is a fixed number, which in non-dimensional units is square root of 8 over 9.
Also, but what does this mean?
What does... okay. So, basically, this the interpretation of this prefactor is a phonon dress.
But this EK is square root of 8 over 9?
Exactly. It's close to 1 in these units. So, well, just what I just told you. So this system can be viewed as a Hamiltonian, with that Hamiltonian driven by noise and damped, and driven by noise and damped in such a way that it goes to an equilibrium where the relative probability of configurations is controlled by this factor. And if you want to actually get some numbers out of this, you have to calculate the partition function, which is just the integral over all possibilities of that factor, what the transfer integral does is allows you to calculate that number, that partition function. So the difficult part of the calculation is actually to evaluate something like this. It becomes difficult because in the origin, not of the nonlinearity, that's not so bad, but of this derivative term. And it's easy to see where the problem starts if you write this thing on a lattice and you have to integrate over all the sites a function which is a function of ti and ti plus 1. Sorry, phi I and phi I plus 1. Because if you discretize the spatial derivative, then the update at each site depends on the values of the neighboring sites. And the transfer operator is just a trick that says, that allows us to rewrite this, actually the whole integral, by assuming that we can solve a certain eigenvalue problem. So it just says, if we can solve this, then this integral which we need to evaluate turns out to be easy. It's not obvious, but you can, if you sit there and look at the it's only about a page calculation. There's nothing fancy in there. It's just a case of suppose we know this, then I can write this thing as a sum of eigenfunctions, and the eigenfunctions integrate out in a certain way.
It's just showing the operator of that lower dimension problem.
So
b squared bx squared plus b.
That's right. Okay. So if you want actually want to solve this equation, then formally it's an infinite dimensional differential equation. The lowest order approximation is a good old Schrodinger equation, which is actually this one right here. Yeah. Go ahead.
Dimensional reduction.
So a one-dimensional classical field theory, you can extract a lot of information by solving a simple quantum mechanics problem. The transfer integral is useful in another way, which is something that Lewis and Salman and I have been looking into. If you can actually, as I already did, perform the thing explicitly on the lattice, and then you can look for what are the lattice corrections to the continuum. And you find that in thermodynamic quantities, the lattice corrections to the continuum go like the second power, delta x squared, where delta x is your lattice spacing, which is nice. So there's no cutoff problems, really. There's no divergences that you have to worry about. Everything is finite. It's just a question of, really, it's like a question of how does your numerical scheme go? Because you can even explicitly put in your discretized Hamiltonian what particular discretization you use for the spatial operators. So it really has a lot of nice properties, and we can go a long way, and a lot of things that you guys spend a lot of your lives worrying about, we don't have to worry about in this particular system.
This is the same worry, but it's just one dimension, therefore it's not super, but super, super real.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So just to tell you exactly what the numerics is, so it's one space dimension, so we just have a line of sites, the Laplacian, which is a spatial operator, discretized in that way, and therefore the SDE, it's a whole of coupled SDEs, and the SDE at each site is second order in time because the original stochastic PDE was. The noise at each site is independent, and the only coupling between sites is from that Laplacian.
Go back to the previous slide, and you get the correlation length from that first. And you read off from that number.
Okay.
Something else.
Yeah, you do actually. So this is phi against x. Now, in the simplest approximation, if the positions of these things, these kinks and anti-kinks, is completely random, and the field just is 1 here and minus 1 there, then the correlation, let's see, then the correlation function being defined like this. A constant times eta minus x over lambda. Lambda equals 1 over 4 rho k. So if rho k is the density of kinks, then the correlation function just has that form. That's assuming two things. Assuming nothing funny happens here. Actually, three things. Nothing funny happens here. These are exactly vertical, and their positions are uncorrelated.
This, not true.
No, none of these things are true, but it's a good approximation at low enough temperature, okay, when really these things are a long way apart from each other.
That from the correlation function, you cannot just derive
no.
a kink density in any straightforward way.
Not that I know of.
Okay. That's making some.
As far as I know, that's the situation. You need to know something more about. You see, you can imagine a given number of kinks. If they're all on top of each other and there's nothing else anywhere else, obviously the correlation function is not going to be of that form.
I mean, in the correlation function, perhaps higher point correlations.
That's
the
right.
Information should be there.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. In principle.
I figured out how to extract it.
That's right.
I don't understand the formula because when the density of kinks goes to zero, lambda goes to.
That's right.
But I would expect when the density of kinks goes to zero, you just get the bare amount.
No, when.
Maybe we normalize by some function, which is one in your.
When the density of kinks goes to zero, my field is one for extremely long periods. So the correlation, the length, is essentially infinite.
No, but you still have this. B of phi, it has a phi square.
That's right.
That's expect an exponential decay coming from there. At low temperature.
So the only thing that's left, so imagine everything is in one minimum, then it's just going to bounce around there.
Right.
Okay, so this number is going to be close to 1 plus a contribution from the bouncing around. So say it bounces between 0.9 and 0.1. Yeah.
Okay. This is saying that in the real system there is a spontaneous symmetry breaking, but if you neglect this density correction, then you do have.
Right. You see, if you average over a long enough volume, then the mean is zero. But long enough volume means that there you've averaged over enough of these ups and downs.
So the difference with the 1 would be determined by
the phonons, exactly. Yeah. Okay. In fact, this is with Luis and Salman again. Staring at the Schrodinger equation with the delta here as the grid spacing, with the corrections, you can convince yourself by some integration by parts that the perturbation due to all of this is equivalent to this. Okay, so what does that tell you? That tells you that if instead of solving the Langevin equation, solving the evolution with this V at each site, I solve it with V and this perturbation at each site, then I should get a better convergence. And we tried that and it seems to work. So here there are three plots. This one is lambda, which is the correlation length. I should tell you a little bit about how I measure that numerically, especially since we're on the topic. So I run my system. Remember the graph, the first graph I showed for a long time. I gather lots of statistics, and a number of times I measure a function like this, which is just counting over the sites. So I get. I get this number, which is just that. Now that looks over a long range, exponential. So how am I actually going to extract that correlation length? Well, the simplest idea is just to fit that to an exponential. In fact, the correlation function is not strictly exponential for the reasons we've just been talking about. You only see the exponential for sufficiently large x. Sufficiently large x means that the other contributions, which are phonons and other things, are not seen anymore. So actually you take something like the derivative of this graph, or the logarithmic derivative, and you end up with a graph like this, which is effectively measuring lambda versus x. So it looks smaller than lambda, it's small x, and then it rises up. So this is lambda now, and it comes to some plateau. But then if I go for large enough x, it gets really hard to measure this correlation function very well, and the thing starts to go a little bit funny. So really, if you want to numerically estimate your correlation length, you're trying to find some plateau at some place. And so the top graph is the standard simulation. This line here is the exact value that you get from the transfer integral. It's actually 1 over the difference of the eigenvalues in that splitting, WKB splitting. But I say it's exact because I just solved that Schrodinger equation numerically, so I can get it as accurately as I want to. And so if we use this counter term in our simulations, we've got a much closer value than what we did without it. So that's encouraging, but we haven't looked into this in great detail yet. There's also a paper recently appeared that proposed using a counter term that goes, instead of like delta x squared, it goes like delta. And so we tried that, and as we suspected, it actually overcorrects. Yeah, that's true. We should
delta
do that.
Now looks off, but it's probably delta pretty big still. So
I should say it's pretty damn hard to get a diagram like this. You have to run for ages and ages to get a nice flat thing on this scale.
But what people do is like in QCD, and so they take the chunk of time of x here where you have this effective mass giving a plateau, and then they go back to the original plot and fit it to an exponential in that region. And another thing you can do is sort of having a smeared out field, blocking or whatever, and because that has a higher overlap on the ground for the first excited state, you can have different observables that give the same long distance correlation. And that way it improves statistics.
Right. Yep.
The average field of some region correlated with an average field shift.
Yep. Yeah. So, well, this seems to be working, but it's really a matter of bashing away at the computer time, and you'd ideally want to have a nice graph of some difference between the continuum value and your finite delta x value as a function of delta x, which should have a nice quadratic behavior, and that sort of works. But you have to remember that every time you decrease your delta x, you're decreasing your effective volume, and you also have to decrease your time step, because otherwise you're not getting accuracy because of time step problems. So it gets really difficult as you try to follow that curve down.
But this x is like you get a factor between 0 and 50.
Right.
So on the previous snapshot, it was like 5.10^4.
That's right.
So.
So I'm averaging over all of those.
All
exactly. Okay. And I'm averaging over lots of times as well.
I was thinking maybe it's not useful to use so many, such a big.
The more statistics, the better, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
You can either do it by having a longer lattice or running it for a longer time.
So but the extrapolation is essential. If you didn't know the exact result,
I would look at that and say,
extrapolating delta to get to.
In principle, here we know the exact result.
Well, you're right on the dot within certain accuracy.
Exactly.
But the coefficient 1/6 has to be renormalized in higher dimensions. That would.
Sure.
What is?
Yeah, remember, this is nice because it's one space dimension, so there is really a finite, well-defined limit for everything as you decrease delta x. So all this was really something of a preamble to what the non-equilibrium part of the talk. So I've tried to convince you that at finite temperature there's some well-defined density of kinks, and there are well-defined other quantities like a correlation length. But what about the actual dynamics? What's happening? I mean, I'm running this, I start from some initial condition, it shouldn't matter. I run it for a long time until I'm happy that it's in equilibrium, and then I keep on running it. So what's the system doing all this time? Well, these kinks and anti-kinks are moving around. If two of them hit each other, they annihilate. In the following scene set, see if these two guys go together, then eventually this part is up there and there's nothing there anymore. So it's like two particles hitting each other and annihilating. And the opposite thing can happen. The phonons that are making this wiggle around every now and then get big enough and some part of this jumps over. So I end up with a new set, a new kink and an anti-kink. So that's the nucleation process. So obviously in equilibrium, this thing balances on average. I have the same number of occurrences of two of them hitting each other and dying, and of two new ones being born. But exactly how does that work? And in fact, there's been some argument about that. Now one would think, since you're having to create two objects with energy Ek, that the nucleation rate should have this factor in it. But there's been a counter-prediction that the nucleation rate actually has that factor in it, a 3 kz instead of a 2, 3 beta instead of 2 beta. And that was based not on our first principles nucleation calculation, we don't have that yet, as far as I know, but on arguments about the annihilation rate, and then saying, well, if the annihilation rate has that scaling, then the nucleation rate must have the same one. And there's another parameter in our theory, which is damping, and we would expect the damping to go like 1 over eta at large eta, the nucleation to go like 1 over damping at large damping, and that does seem to be true. Something funny happens at low damping, you're getting closer and closer to a Hamiltonian system, and, well, just clearly it can't go like 1 over damping all the way to damping zero, but something well-defined does happen at damping zero. That's right. So, well, what we see is that the nucleation rate goes up and up and up with a 1 over eta behavior at large eta, but then it flattens out at small eta, and it seems to go to a finite limit. Yep. I'll come to that. This is the one we believe in. But there's prefactors here which depend on damping. And that prefactor has this behavior. It goes like 1 over damping at large damping and does something else at small damping. So let me show some actual dynamics. So now, think if you will of one horizontal slice as being like the first graph I showed you, or being like this thing. So where there's nothing, where it's just white, that means the configuration is close to here. Where there's a dot, that means there's a zero crossing. So if you can see a continuous line, that's the position of a kink or an anti-kink that stays around for a long time. So it's present at all these time slices. Sorry, I didn't put it here. Time goes this way, and space goes that way. So there are a few of these that are very noticeable, that last for a long, long time. And there are lots more that where two are born together, they wiggle around and they kill each other. In fact, there are thousands more that you can just barely see. When you just see a dot or some small blob, it's two of them that are born, didn't stay around for very long, and they killed each other. And that's the overwhelmingly most probable event.
Does this depend on how long you school?
No. Well, it's a bit of an art, but we satisfy ourselves that it doesn't. Yeah. That's right. Exactly. So suppose at some time, it's also a question of what's a kink and what's not. See, suppose this is really messy, and at some time it happens to poke up above zero. Is that a kink anti-kink pair or not? The only way to know really is just to wait longer to see if it really becomes one or not.
If you
build theoretical symbol for counting the stages.
You do it by hand.
Basically. That's right. That's right. It's an intuitive thing. I mean, it's intuitively obvious to everyone from that first graph that there is something that makes sense to call a kink. But when you start thinking about the details, what exactly is a kink and what isn't? Well, it's up to you to define it, as long as you define it in a consistent way. We can actually start to analyze the dynamics and understand the dynamics by imagining there are two species, and one are these what we call S kinks, and there's a well-defined way to define the difference. Every kink is born with a partner anti-kink. So a kink whose partner is still alive is a D kink, and a kink whose partner has already been killed is an S kink. So we can actually explicitly do this, follow the evolution and count the number of each types. And so most of the D kinks are just these little bubbles that have very short lifetimes. And some fraction of the S kinks live for a very long time. And that's where, okay. Well, just let me step backward for a second. Okay. So in the same way that I have to start with some initial condition, let it equilibrate, and then start doing things, in the same way, you're absolutely right. I start with some initial condition, so there's some kinks whose previous history, by definition, I can't know. So I have to wait a long time, actually, until all the kinks, or 99% of them, are ones whose full evolution I've been able to follow. That's exactly right.
You can
define it at any density in principle. Other things happen when the temperature gets high enough. So the higher the temperature, the higher the density. And what happens is when the temperature starts getting high, there's so much noise here that it really becomes just stupid to even try to count kinks. So if you've done it at low enough temperature that you can count the kinks, then it's not a problem. Just one thing relating back to the previous slide, so that now we can do that actual space-time analysis and look at these things forming, we can actually explicitly count, okay, how many nucleation events were there. And we find that we get this factor, we get the 2 beta factor, which you'd expect from intuition. This one, actually, we're getting there, and I'll talk about it a bit more here. So this is just a slide that tells you what I just told you. So a kink and anti-kink are born together. They stay D's all their lives. They kill each other. Another thing that can happen is 2 of them are nucleated reasonably close to each other. They kill with the corresponding members, and then there are these 2 strays left. A third thing can happen is one of these strays comes along and hits one of these guys, and that guy becomes a stray. And the last thing that can happen is 2 of these can bump into each other and kill each other. So these 2 things have to balance each other. That's what's creating US's, that's what's killing US's. This one conserves S's because there's one at the beginning, one at the end.
That's supposed to
have
2 S's in the middle.
Uh-huh. Got
together.
That's fine. That's
stray or
these 2? Yeah, exactly. Once if the partner is no longer alive, it's a stray. So both of these guys have had their partner killed. So that's fine. It's true. Once you start thinking about this, you have a lot of fun. Yeah. And you come up with titles for talks like The Secret Life of Kinks. Okay, so no, there are actually 2 lifetimes, which I'll come back to some theory for that in a second. But this one is very short, and the lifetime corresponding for this is much longer. Because these guys are always close to each other. relatively, whereas these guys in principle can be a long way apart from each other.
Would you go close in order of the correlation
length? Let's say the typical initial separation of this would be the correlation length. A typical separation here is much less. It's the order of it's something to do with the nucleation process. It would be,
It's essentially just separation, but I mean, but the kink diffuse, right? You have
right.
And it diffuses.
Uh-huh.
So is the lifetime basically just separation?
I'll come to that in a second. The short answer is going to be just calculate the time, postulating some initial separation for them to hit each other.
That's right.
And the reason why there's a different lifetime is that these guys are typically much closer to each other than these guys. So before I get onto that, I should say something about how do the kinks actually move. I just agreed with the statement that they diffuse, because that's pretty much what we observe, at least at eta greater than about 1. Actually, eta greater than 10 to the minus 1, it seems to be fine as well. If you plot a graph of the mean, so I can measure the position of a kink as a function of time, and I measure its mean square displacement, it has a nice straight line as a function of time. And that's what you would expect from the following argument. Just think about an isolated kink, so the configuration is a one kink at a certain position. What would I expect that position to do as a function of time? If I just plug this ansatz into the original equation, there's some nice calculations because that k has a certain property, and I just get out a simple equation which really looks like the original SPDE, except now it's an SODE, and it looks like that. And at large,
what's double?
So this is just a white noise. Okay, I didn't define it, sorry. Okay, it's just a white noise with that amplitude. So there is an effect of diffusivity which in this approximation has this form. And once again, it can't be quite so simple if I let eta go all the way to zero. Because if I do let eta go all the way to zero, I get a kind of ballistic motion of kinks. So there's something... So the effect of diffusivity in that case will depend on how often they bump into each other, because another thing that happens at zero eta is they don't actually have to kill each other when they hit each other, whereas in the large eta they always do. And secondly, the sloshing around of these phonons is probably more important at low eta.
So this form is not just that they're rigid, also that they're non-interacting.
Exactly. All it is saying is saying, what does one kink do? And the answer, the simple answer, is it diffuses with that diffusivity.
So it's also why there's no mass? You might expect there's a mass?
Only in the sense that the kink mass appears there. Only in that sense.
Zero mode for
That's exactly right. It's a zero mode. So it can do whatever it wants. Yeah. Exactly. Okay, so now, what if I assume that kinks just diffuse? Suppose a kink and an anti-kink have an initial separation B, at what time will they hit each other? The time at which they will hit each other is given by that distribution. And the interesting factor, don't worry about the B's, that's just initial separation, is this number here. So it's t to the minus 3 over 2. That's nice, it's an exact formula, but it's obviously not the whole story. For nothing else, because t to the minus 3 over 2 does not have a mean or anything. It diverges in both the top and the bottom, actually. I've already cut off the bottom by assuming initial separation. But the point is, if you look at the statistics of Brownian excursions actually starting from zero, then there are an infinitely large number of infinitely small ones. But it's reasonable to assume there is some characteristic initial separation which is defined by the details of the nucleation process, which will be something like the phonon scale, which will be of order... Actually, I'll come back to it, or maybe I won't have time. it turns out I can kind of explicitly measure what B, effective B, is in our theory, and it's number 2, so it's more or less what you'd expect. Okay, but even that can't be the whole story, because it's a property of Brownian motion that you can have arbitrarily long excursions. So in fact, even this distribution doesn't have a finite mean or anything. Now, why is that? Well, let's go back to the D and S idea. Think of this B as an initial separation of the two D kinks. So a newly nucleated pair starts off a distance B apart. So they move about and they can hit each other. So this is the density for them hitting each other. But we know that's not the only thing that can happen. Some other guy can also come along and hit them. So how am I going to model that? Well, what I tried was just postulate that there's a constant probability per unit time, for as long as these guys are both alive, of being hit by something else. And in that case, you get a finite lifetime for the kink-anti-kink pair. And in fact, you get a finite answer for everything you want. And it's very nice, at least on first glance. So I get a fairly small lifetime, it turns out, for the D kinks, and I get a longer lifetime, mu, for the S kinks. But at the stage, all I've told you is that I postulated that mu. So now what I have to do is an argument for mu, and the argument for mu is something like is something like the following. Space that way, time that way again. So there's some characteristic density of kinks, and there's some newborn pair that is born and wiggles around. So how often would you expect one of them to be hit by one of these other guys? So this distance is proportional to 1 over the density of kinks. And the exit time for a Brownian particle from a region of that width is proportional to 1 over d rho squared. So what I do is I put, let's move to minus 1, is a constant over d rho squared. The important thing, the only thing I really want at this stage, is that mu is proportional to rho squared. Go ahead. That's right. Yeah. Sorry. This is the exit from the whole region.
Right. Well, yeah. In that case, you don't need. One side is the partner that it's going to know.
Right.
And the other side.
Coming in. That's right.
You don't need the initial analysis. Just take it with it.
You could do that, but it depends. You see, if I give you an arbitrary region and I ask you what's your exit time, it depends on where in that region you started. If you started really close to one boundary, then your mean exit time is much smaller. That's in practice the problem that I'm solving. So just think about one of these guys for a second. It's born very close to another one and very far from another one, from a third one. So the mean time given that it hits that is much less than the mean time given that it hits that.
Exactly.
Which is what the point of this consideration is, to try and understand why there are two time scales. Okay, I can do a couple more things. One is explicitly measure do statistics on the separation between a D kink and its partner, and a separation between any two given kinks. So So the separation between any two given kinks is exponentially distributed with a slope that's just basically twice the density, because of the equal density of kinks and anti-kinks. And the distribution of separations of d-kinks is also exponential, but with a different factor. It turns out to be just four times as big. And that's what you would expect if you do a calculation of Brownian motion killed at a constant rate, and you ask, what's the distribution of times of distances from the origin? So that works. Before you fall asleep, there's a first little summary slide. So we've done a few nice things. Numerics is getting better, and the theoretical analysis is looking very promising. But there are several things that we need to do. We don't really understand, well, we need a better approximation for kink motion. Even at low temperature, that just simple form that I gave you is not exact. And something even more drastic happens when damping is very low. There's a paper by Wider and Schrieffer from the 70s where they predict that the kink diffusivity goes like the square of the temperature at zero damping, which would be interesting. All the simulations I've showed you are for additive noise. What if I put multiplicative noise, meaning that noise term is not just independent of anything, it's multiplied by some system variable. There are arguments that say at low damping that should speed up the approach to equilibrium, and it would be an interesting thing if it turns out to be true. There's no first principles nucleation calculation that I know of, and we need to go to higher dimensions because this is just a toy model really at this stage. And lastly on this slide, all this stuff is interesting from chemical reaction point of view, and there is some theory on this. So these little kinks bouncing around, or I just modeled them as particles when I talked about some of the analysis, they can be chemical reactants moving around and hitting each other and something happening. So to put that in their language and maybe see what problems need to be solved in that field would be interesting. That was the first part of the talk. How long did it take? 50. 50. Okay.
I also realized my fault. We're now overlapping with this.
Okay. The second part should not be as long as the first. Go ahead.
This gamma nucleation, the nucleation rate. Did you find this to depend in any way on your cooling?
No. Well, the prefect, probably. Well, yes, it does.
So yeah. Like
exactly. So that's true.
Maybe it's no good theoretical definition.
That's probably the final answer. But the important thing from our point of view is that with any definition and at any cooling scheme, the scaling of the nucleation rate with the density is the one we find. That we've always found to be true. And that's, up till now, is still a matter of controversy in the literature.
But suppose this model has an application to some
physical system.
Right. Would then that application tell you what to do?
That's exactly what I hope, yes. If these things really are atoms, or kinks in some atom lattice.
Some question you want from phenomenology to answer, and maybe it's not this question, maybe it's just a slightly different question.
That's exactly right. Yeah, what I hope is that we've put some work into understanding how to solve this type of equations, and now when applications come along we can say, okay, this is the problem you're going to run into, this is how you should do it. Okay. Would you rather I finished in 10 minutes? As opposed to 25 minutes? Yes, is there another talk starting in 10 minutes or something? Or
no, they
already started.
This is my fault. We should have started earlier, but I think it's now.
Too late anyway. Okay. Okay. So I'm going to talk about this almost the same system, except that it's a quench, so I'm actually going to make one of those parameters in the original SPDE time-dependent. I'll show you the equation on the next slide. And this is work that I did with Esteban Moro, who was a guy from Madrid who came here, came to Los Alamos about 6 months ago. And there's a background to this, although it's not the reason that I originally got into it, that something called the Zurich scenario, which was an idea to test things about the early universe using experiments on liquid helium. And the point is that if your potential explicitly changes in time from a single well to a double well, then the number of kinks that you expect to get formed will explicitly depend on how fast you change that parameter. And so some numerics and calculations were done to figure out exactly what is that dependence. That's what I'm going to talk to you about. This is the reason why I got into it, and this is not even a stochastic PDE, this is a stochastic ODE at this stage. So it's a pitchfork bifurcation which has a critical point at the value G of the parameter, which here I've written as mu t equals zero. But if I actually do what I've implied here and I make G a function of time, then I don't just see the solution following that branch. It lingers around here, and then at some point later it jumps away. For later reference, so this is a much larger value of the noise. That's the only difference between the two graphs. The noise here is so small that you can't even see it, which has the benefit that y stays close to zero for a long time, meaning you don't need to worry, sorry, x stays close to zero for a long time, you don't need to worry about that term for a long time. But it turns out that exactly when this jump away happens depends on the value of the noise level.
What was G again?
So G here is mu t. So G is linearly increasing with time. And this is actually a trajectory of that equation.
And it can also go the other way.
It could do, exactly, that's right. In fact, if you've done it slowly enough, it'll go up or down with exactly equal probability.
So are you just like putting it on top?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yep. Well, I actually started at some.
But it's also, I should read the start.
That's right.
This
exactly.
Flying around, you can read
it. Yeah, so. I'll draw this since it'll be useful later. So my potential, which is just 1 half gx squared, starts off in this form, and my particle starts here. So what it does is it slides down to zero. That's this part of the graph. Meanwhile, explicitly in time, I keep changing this until I get this form. So that moment, sorry, the moment when it's actually flat is g equals zero. But my particle doesn't start sliding down at exactly that time. It hangs around for quite a while, and then at some time when the potential is already quite a long way pointing downwards, it falls off quite suddenly. That was an ODE. The SDE is just this. Del squared, that's right. Okay. So second derivative in time, second derivative in space, that's just a Laplacian. Damping, I've changed the name to gamma. And G is a function of time, which will have the same time dependence as on the previous slide. The same and temperature relationship, although that won't be so important. Okay. Later on I will. Yeah, I will do something like that later. Okay, so what does this thing do? I start off in the single well regime. So I've got a system which is sitting, which now has an extra dimension out here. It's sitting in that well, so the field is bouncing around in there. And there are lots of zero crossings. I explicitly change this potential as a function of time, at when G passes zero, it's flat. When G is positive, it's actually pointing downwards. And at some positive time, I see this dramatic decrease in the number of zeros, and I get left with a relatively small number of well-defined kinks and anti-kinks. And the question I want to answer is exactly how many of those do I get? There are two graphs here. One, they're for different values of the damping. So one was, is it written there? I don't think so. So in one case, large damping means gamma is, say, 10, and small damping means gamma is, say, 10 to the minus 1. Now, the idea of the analysis, and this is really originally due to Wojciech Zurek, is that there are three regimes in the evolution. The first one is where the particle doesn't really notice that the potential is moving, it's just doing what it would have done anyway. And this is in the symmetry restored regime. And then in the second region, the thing's starting to roll over, and the system can't really follow in the sense that the critical exponents that you normally expect are found. It can't keep up, because it's basically because of critical slowing down. Once the potential starts to move, the potential is moving, once that time scale is comparable with the critical slowing down time scales, then something different happens. It's non-equilibrium. And then at some later time, when it's well into the symmetry broken regime, bang, you get these kinks, and they stick around because there's this fairly strong non-linearity that's keeping the kinks where they are. This is independent of the arguments I gave you in the first half of the talk, because the timescales for all this are much faster than the timescales for this diffusion and killing each other.
Yeah, when you say critical, you mean in the first part of the language is the Fonin set of critical, isn't it? Because
that's right.
You always are not critical.
But that's a
larger scale.
Exactly. So this is Fonin's, because we're still thinking about it in the just single well regime. Okay, so coming back to your question. Now, what makes analysis of this actually much easier than you would have expected is the fact that the field lingers so long close to the bottom of that minimum that you can forget about the nonlinear term for a long time. And once you do that, you can do some non-dimensionalization, and you only get left with two parameters. So there's a mu and a non-dimensionalized damping. And it gets even better. If the SPDE is linear, then its statistics are Gaussian. And there's an exact relationship for the number of zeros, the density of zeros, for a Gaussian random field. With an if, the if being that your correlation function has to have zero derivative at x equals zero, which is absolutely not true in the static regime up here, but it turns out to be true if you follow the evolution, and at the time when it's about to fall down that hill, it actually has a correlation function with a flat top. So you know exactly how many zeros there are, and that number should not depend on your grid spacing. So I can spare you some details. Sure. Well, it's exact. It's fine. It's exact for a Gaussian random field with that correlation function. So, I could separately measure the correlation function and.
You have built the other methods for localizing kinks. The two methods.
Ah, I see. Yeah. In this case, it gets very easy, because what's happening is, this potential is moving outwards, and these things are really getting stretched. So it's really obvious where there's a kink and where there's not. So I'm sparing you a few gory details, and I'll just tell you that for low damping, defined in that non-dimensional factor alpha, then the number of zeros that I get left over with scales like the third power of the rate at which I increase the critical parameter. And when the damping is large, it's kind of like, one third, and it's kind of like mu times gamma to the 1/4. So gamma was the original damping before I non-dimensionalized it. And
so remind me, mu was the bench rate.
Exactly. G equals mu t.
So, and also, so I mean, what was Zurek's?
So he got the same answers by dimensional arguments, essentially. He got that's what he predicted, and he was right. Yeah. Okay. What he didn't do is something like this, which is actually go through some of the details numerically. So those expressions had prefactors. Okay. So what I need to evaluate is the correlation function. Okay, so I've got a Gaussian random field. It's the SPDE is non-autonomous and well, stochastic, obviously, but it's still linear, so I can write down everything. It separates into the SDE for each Fourier mode is independent, so I can solve that. It has a time-dependent mean square, so I get the correlation function by summing up the time-dependent mean squares of the Fourier modes. This is all exact as long as the linear approximation is valid. Okay, and then the step in the argument is to say, okay, all this is valid up till the time when the thing falls down the hill. And at the time that it falls down the hill, the number of zeros is just frozen in. That's the assumption.
So you just use that number to calculate it linear.
Exactly.
Does this thing involve things with zero? Is there any problem with exactly.
No, it's a nice smooth function. It's fine. In one dimension, one space dimension. In fact, it has a Gaussian form.
It's, I don't know what it's actually controlled by here. If it were 1D without the stochastic,
if it were 1D in this regime, then the correlation function is exponential, which is what you typically expect for a kind of static system. And the reason why you get a different form is because the whole thing's dynamic. So it's a correlation function with exponents which are time dependent, but that's fine, you can calculate them. So, which brings me to just one complication. So I can actually calculate the time when it falls down the hill and measure the number of zeros at that time. And so the squares are numerics, and the solid line is the formulae I showed you. So it works really well. There's no fitting or anything. Now, if of course I let it run for some longer time, then some of these guys get stretched out, get pulled out. You might remember one of the first graphs, some of them do actually join up. So the whole graph gets shifted down at some later time. And the shifting down happens faster at lower damping, but the scaling is preserved.
So the slope here, it is 1/4.
Exactly. So that's, yeah, that's right. Okay. I can even do a graph against the non-dimensionalized damping to show the two regimes. So in the low damping, it actually doesn't depend on the damping anymore, and then it comes to a regime where it does. I can do that as a function of damping. So that was all that the numerics for this system turned out to be reasonably easy compared to the one I talked about in the first half of the talk. And just one more thing I want to mention. An interesting phenomenon, if you do this in the low damping regime, so I've been telling you that the number of zeros is very large here. It decreases, and then it sometimes gets frozen in. In the low damping regime, that's not true anymore. Not exactly true. What happens is the number of zeros decreases quite rapidly, and then it bounces back a couple of times. And the intuitive explanation for that is that I've drawn this just as if it's going, everything's going to infinity, but it's actually not. It's going to a double well thing. So there seems to be some possibility of some part of the field rolling down this hill and then coming all the way back up again, and doing this for some reason it seems to do this twice, and then after that they're like that. I don't know why, but that's the intuitive explanation. Right, okay. In this case, the whole thing is devised in a way that it's not the initial conditions that matter, but there's a temperature and a sweep rate. But it depends, yeah, exactly. Yeah. In this.
But as you know, we've seen our principle of fact, it's higher up.
Right.
If we choose.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah, for a point of reference, Lewis has done simulations where instead of slowly increasing the frame rate, he actually just changes it. That's right? So it's like a very large mu limit of this calculation. I think I'll spare you further details and just say that both of the systems that I've talked about are quite simple, but there are some fairly complete calculations that you can do on them, and I quite enjoy doing them.